Welcome back, everyone, and it's a great pleasure to have Masha with us again this week. She survived this explosion attack last week, and so we're glad to hear more about the binary black holes beyond general relativity. So please take it away, Masha.
Yeah, thanks again, everybody, so much for coming. Just in case you missed the first kind of interrupted part of the talk last week, I'm just going to briefly go through what we talked about, and then I'm going to move on to the new stuff. And so broadly, what we talked about last week was this, the fact that, you know, nature isn't classical. We have this theory of general relativity. However, we need to reconcile it, you know, at some scale with quantum mechanics into a beyond GR theory of gravity. And, you know, we have this question of, can we observe gravity beyond GR? Then I sort of explained that really in order to look for gravity at its most extreme, if we want to potentially see the breakdown of general relativity, we want to probe gravity in its, you know, most strong field, nonlinear, highly dynamical regime, a really good system to turn to are kind of stellar mass binary black hole mergers, as we see here. So our best laboratory. And then I briefly talked about the fact that, you know, these binary black hole mergers really do probe this regime of gravity. And the great thing about them is that they emit gravitational waves. And the great thing about gravitational waves is that we can then detect them here on Earth. And so potentially, if this regime could contain, you know, some beyond GR physics, given that it, you know, does really probe gravity at its most extreme, it's our best laboratory, you know, potentially the gravitational waves that travel from the system to our gravitational wave detectors here on Earth could contain beyond GR signatures. And so I talked about the fact that presently people look for beyond GR physics with gravitational waves within, for example, the LIGO and Virgo scientific collaborations using null tests and parameterized tests. I talked about those, but really what's kind of missing from this picture are model-dependent tests, which is where we take a specific beyond GR model of gravity, we test it against the data that we have in our detector, sort of using as our hypothesis that this beyond GR theory is correct, and then either we, you know, constrain this theory or perhaps we detect, you know, a deviation with some significance. And the reason we're missing these tests is because we're missing beyond GR waveforms. We have had for over like 15 years now predictions for what gravitational waves look like for binary black hole mergers in general relativity, thanks to the field of numerical relativity. But we really lack these in beyond GR theories of gravity. So I talked about this goal that we have, right, of using numerical relativity, which is solving the, you know, highly nonlinear coupled partial differential equations governing the behavior of space-time on supercomputers. I talked about using this field of numerical relativity to really complete this picture and make these missing beyond GR gravitational waveforms. So really kind of delving into this field and building this field of numerical relativity beyond general relativity. I then talked about specific theories that we're going to consider, namely what are known as beyond GR effective field theories, where you treat the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity, sort of schematically shown here, as the first term in an expansion and curvature. So here there's this, you know, perturbation parameter governing your expansion. And then you have terms here that are quadratic in curvature, terms that are cubic in curvature, et cetera. This kind of script R squared is general in the sense that you can think about, for example, Riemann tensor contracted with itself, Ricci tensor contracted with itself, dual of Riemann contracted with itself, Ricci scalar squared, and various combinations thereof. But really the idea is that The terms that you add here are meant to, in the series, even though this action overall is classical, they're meant to encompass underlying quantum gravity effects, specifically, you know, tied to these interesting high energy theories that people think about, such as string theory and loop quantum gravity. And for our purposes, we're going to go to second order in this class of theories, focusing on what are known as quadratic gravity theories. And in particular, we're going to focus on dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, which again modifies the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity through a term that is quadratic in curvature. This is called the Pontryagin density. And there's a coupling constant here, L, which has dimensions of length. When L goes to zero, we recover general relativity. So within this theory, you know, you kind of have general relativity in the sense that it's a limit of this theory. And then in order to make this theory dynamical, we have to couple space-time curvature to a scalar field. And this is a pseudo-scalar field. I also last time talked about Einstein-Dilettante-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, which is quite similar. Again, having a coupling parameter, in this case, square root of alpha has dimensions of length. These coupling parameters that have dimensions of length, you can think about them as the length scale below which quantum gravity effects become important. So this is, you know, the kind of cutoff of your effective field theory. You're saying, you know, these classical terms that I'm adding to the action are meant to encompass some underlying quantum gravity effects. And then below this length scale here, I expect, you know, that quantum gravity effects are important. And I talked briefly about the differences between these two theories because they are two, you know, theories of quadratic gravity, namely that in dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, only rotating black holes are modified, whereas in Einstein-Dilettante-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, both Schwarzschild and Kerr black holes are modified. So the fact that, you know, rotating black holes are modified in these theories is already good for us, because if we have a binary black hole system, we know that even in the, you know, in spiral phase, let's say the space-time metric will be different. And also, you know, after the ring down phase. And then one thing that I mentioned just really quickly is that if you think about the leading order modification to the gravitational radiation in these theories, specifically in the in-spiral phase, where you can think about a post-Newtonian expansion, so series of a characteristic velocity of the system over c squared, Einstein-Dilettante-Gauss-Bonnet gravity has a modification at negative 1 pn order relative to gr. So this is a modification, this is a beyond gr modification to the in-spiral that comes a lot earlier than, for example, the case in dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, where you have to go all the way to 2 pn. So you have to go to, you know, a regime where, you know, you can't do like Hulse-Taylor pulsar, because there it's a lower pn order that you kind of recover. But you know, here the later kind of you go into the n-spiral, the more kind of pn terms that you require to accurately describe physics, you know, there you can potentially, you know, see these beyond gr modifications to the n-spiral. And so I kind of ended on this note that what we've done is produce the first binary black hole merger waveforms in these higher curvature theories of gravity. And specifically, one thing that I mentioned is that without going into too much detail, again, the kind of thing that we did was using something known as an order reduction scheme. Technical details are kind of available here. But the key thing here is that you say you have a GR binary black hole background. You know that deviations to general relativity are small, and so you can treat space-time metric as general relativity plus some beyond GR corrections, and similar thing for the scalar fields that make these theories dynamical. And so ultimately, you can compute using this scheme the leading order beyond GR correction to the metric, and hence the leading order beyond GR correction to the gravitational radiation once you have this correction to the metric. And this whole scheme is scale invariant in the sense that the overall mass of the system scales out as it does in, you know, typical numerical relativity simulations. But more importantly, these coupling parameters, right? These things that have dimensions of length that correspond to the length scale below which quantum gravity effects become important, also scale out when you do this scheme. And because at the end of the day, you say that my full metric, right, is the GR metric plus this, you know, coupling parameter, it's going to be to the fourth power, but that doesn't matter, times this beyond GR, leading order beyond GR correction. And so you do one simulation for one set of binary black hole parameters, you know, a mass ratio and two spin vectors, and then you're good for appropriate values of this coupling parameter. And I'll talk about what appropriate values are later on. And so indeed, we've performed simulations with parameters, mass ratio and spin vectors, consistent with GW150914, the first LIGO detection. That also had quite, yes.
May I interrupt?
Yes.
Okay. So the way you set up your system, does this involve one approximation or two approximations? You mentioned in the beginning that the Lagrangian, you make an expansion and you only take the lowest order term. But couldn't this, in principle, lead to an order one change of the metric, of the space-time metric? For example, with poor GR, there is no black hole formed, and then now you add these post-GR effects, and then the black hole forms. So the two space-times differ by order one. And I think what you just said means that you only assume that the difference between the metrics is also small, another epsilon. So is this two approximations, or do I misunderstand?
No, that's a good question. So going back to the action of the theory, the correction comes at order L squared. Then if you think about the, and you know, you're still dealing with the Einstein-Hilbert action here. So, you know, you still have, you know, this GR piece of the action. And then when you do this order reduction scheme, this piece is like order L to the zero. This piece is like order L squared. So here comes your leading order scalar field, beyond GR scalar field. And then this piece comes in as L to the fourth. And so your overall metric is to leading order beyond GR corrected metric is this piece plus L to the fourth times this piece. Now, when you do this, you assume you pick a value of L such that there are a couple things here. One is because what we do is we perturb the space-time metric. What you basically do is you perturb the space-time metric. You stick it in now to the you know, field equations of the theory. And what you actually get is you recover a principal part, which is that of general relativity. Now you have source terms that are these, you know, quadratic curvature things. So that's where you're getting your beyond GR dynamics from. But because you have the same principal part as general relativity, you know, you for example, you expect things to the characteristic fields to be basically the same. You expect things to travel at the speed of light and stuff. And so all of the like mathematical analysis that's been done on the principal part of general relativity, you know, all of that holds, right? Then you have a well-posed initial value problem. Now, you have made the assumption here that this is a correction on top of general relativity. So what you need, and you're always going to have these black holes because you're always going to have this part of the metric. And then you have some corrections and that, you know, these things have like the same principal part as like gravitational waves, for example, if you have no source term. Now you've also, which I'll get into this a little later, you know, you've also, you also assume that L is such that this piece multiplied by L to the fourth is smaller than your geometric. So you're not wildly modifying things. Okay. And I'll get into how we kind of compute that later on in this talk.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thanks for the question.
Something. Yes. So imagine you were doing this in the context of black holes. You have black holes initially. And for example, you say, okay, let's try to collapse this scalar field into a black hole. I imagine that's as a possible experiment you could do.
So if you didn't have a black hole, you would just have, let's say you had flat space, then in, for example, dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, in both of these theories, this higher curvature term would vanish. And so you would just recover, I think you would just recover a scalar field in GR, like when you just have a, scalar field chilling on flat space. But then when you start to actually, source curvature, in that case, you would expect, I think, your dynamics to be modified from that of just scalar field collapse and general relativity, because you have these, you now have these additional curvature terms entering into the system. And so, this is an interesting question. To do this, you have to have the ability to, solve the full like coupled system. With back reaction and everything, because if you do it in the order reduction way, then you just have like flat space and then stuff happening on top of flat space. But that is an interesting question. Like what happens with just gravitational collapse in these theories?
Yeah. So what I was thinking is, okay, you start with the poles very far away, say, so everything looks like flat space, and then you put it like imploding, basically like colliding. At some point, gravity is going to start being strong. So, you're going to have your metric evolving there, and you could use this metric then to source the modifications and then use as you're doing the same procedure. But going back to what Eric said, if you fine tune this process, probably you can find a point in which maybe this doesn't collapse in GR. Mm-hmm. But once you source it, it ends up collapsing, and then you are in trouble.
Yeah, like once you reach this, once you reach like a large enough perturbation such that in GR you'd have collapse versus non-collapse, and then but you would expect your beyond GR thing to just shift this ever so slightly. Yeah, then you'd get a breakdown of this scheme. That's a very good point. And I think an important caveat to include. So thanks for bringing that to my attention. Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. So going back to binary black hole systems, we're going to simulate systems in these order reduced beyond GR theories that are consistent with GW15914, the first LIGO detection, and one of the loudest, because the overall mass scales out, we don't have to, introduce physical dimensions when doing this. But when I talk about like astrophysical relevance of these things, we do need to introduce a mass scale. And so just keeping in mind that GW150914 overall was 68 solar masses. Of course, if you go to lower masses, you're going to get higher space-time curvatures, so your constraints are going to be better. But for our purposes, let's work with this astrophysical system that we know exists. So we have produced the first binary black hole merger waveforms and higher curvature theories of gravity. So here we have, for example, the gravitational radiation for dynamical Trin-Simons gravity. You can see that the amplitude and the phase are modified as I increase this coupling parameter from general relativity. One thing that I should point out is I mentioned before that the modification comes as this coupling parameter to the fourth power. Bear in mind that you tick the coupling parameter up by a little bit, you're really ticking it up by something that's, to the fourth power. So you have this kind of quadratic business. And then if I wanted to put in a mass scale, so let's do 68 solar masses for GW5914, you know, looking at the gravitational wave strain in this case, you can by eye see a modification when L is of order, you know, 10 kilometers. And this makes sense because that's kind of the horizon scale of the problem, right? That's the size of the horizons of these black holes. And so that's kind of the physics that you can probe. Of course, if you had less massive black holes, let's say you had primordial black holes, you know, then you could really probe kind of by eye a smaller length scale. But in this case, you know, this is kind of what you can see by eye. And of course, you know, you do have a modification, and so you can make L as small as you want. There's just the question of would your detector be able to detect this deviation, which I'll get into in a second.
Yeah, so on that, once you start seeing differences, would you not worry perhaps that there would be further differences? Because I mean, the assumption here is that the, as you were saying before, that the characteristic structure is governed by the principal part. The principal part is still is the one from Einstein's equations, and then there, all modes will propagate at the speed of light. However, when you turn on the corrections, that's no longer true. You now have a dispersion relation that knows about the particular different modes of different frequencies will propagate at different speeds, and that's now thrown away in the procedure. So then the difference could actually be when you turn this to the length scale of order of 10 kilometers, maybe the difference will be a lot more marked than what you can see here. I mean, I'm not saying that you will see less. So the fact that you're seeing something, yeah, that would be a clear difference, but maybe differences are already showing up earlier.
Yeah. And another thing kind of related to that is I didn't mention here the question of gravitational wave propagation. And I have kind of papers in that realm as well, or paper in that realm as well, where here we've just been talking about modified dynamics beyond GR dynamics in the strong field region, where you're kind of correcting the source black holes. But then what you do is when you compute the gravitational radiation, you do it in kind of a similar way, where you take the you know, Newman-Penrose scalar electric magnetic vial tensor parts that you use to compute the gravitational radiation, you perturb these around general relativity. So you say, okay, I have a metric that's GR plus some correction. What's the, you know, form that I take for my full, you know, gravitational radiation? You're treating this gravitational radiation, you know, using this order reduction scheme so that everything is consistent within the order reduction scheme. But it's true that, you know, theories like Chern-Simons gravity, if you think about what's called like non-dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, that modifies gravitational wave propagation. And that is something that we can actually constrain with LIGO observations presently. But I'm not touching on that here. Here, I'm just saying that strong field dynamics are modified. And I'm just going to say that the gravitational waves, you know, propagate without being affected by, you know, a DCS scalar field somewhere out there.
For these plots you've been showing us, they've just been for sort of one or two orbits before merger. Is that because of this worry about secular errors accumulating? And could you say a little bit about how you decide how long you can integrate the orbit for?
Yes, that's great, because that's my next slide.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's good. It's good. Okay, so and here's kind of what you get at Einstein-Dilthoff-Gauss-Bonnet gravity. You know, again, we can pick some values of this length scale and kind of see where we see these modifications. Here I pulled out the mass scale. But, you know, we can always reintroduce it. And so to get to both Eric's question and Will's question, we need to think about the fact that, yes, we're doing this order reduction scheme, and we have the kind of constraint that we're, you know, we are in a perturbative regime, And so the first thing we have to think about is known as an instantaneous regime of validity. Basically, what we have is, you know, our GR spacetime metric, and we have some leading order beyond GR correction to this metric. What we want is we want to pick a What we want is we want to pick a value of this coupling parameter such that metric here is smaller, this beyond GR metric here times, you know, the coupling parameter to the fourth power is less than the GR metric. And, you know, you can introduce some number here, like, you know, you want it to be like 10 times smaller, you want it to be 100 times smaller, like that kind of depends on your tolerance. But overall, you know, you have this constraint that, you know, in the space time, you want this, you know, correction to be smaller than your background metric. Now, all these kind of numbers here just come from like the action and math. So ignore this, but the general principle is there. And the way that we do this on the space-time is we basically do this point-wise. So if you think about numerical relativity, we have a grid, we have you know, we have access to these metrics, you know, point-wise in the space-time. And basically what we do is at each point we compare these and then we kind of pick the maximum over the space-time slice at each time. And it kind of comes as no surprise that this beyond GR modification is largest, you know, close to the black hole horizons. And so really that's what's dictating your regime of validity. And so what we can do is at each point here, we can say, okay, there's a value of L over GM such that perturbation theory is invalid versus perturbation theory is valid, just based on this kind of tolerance that you've set. And, you know, because we do it on each time slice, basically you kind of expect that the lowest value of L over GM, so this is like kind of the ultimate value that you're allowed to have, comes near merger around when the two black holes are going to come together. So that's known as the instantaneous regime of validity. Now, to get to Will's question, we have to think about what is known as a secular regime of validity. So going back to the order reduction scheme, one thing about this scheme is that you're not correcting for the positions of the black holes, right? You're computing this leading order correction to the metric, but you're still on a GR background, right? That's still kind of telling you about your rate of n spiral. And so there's this, you know, concern that perhaps, you know, if you let's say you start like 100 orbits before merger, you know, in GR, you're going to have some rate of n spiral, right? Governed by, you know, PM theory, or you can do it in NR. And then for your beyond GR theory, you expect a faster rate of n spiral due to the fact that you're losing energy to this scalar field. And so ultimately, these two rates of n spiral are going to diverge, and then you are going to be out of this kind of perturbative regime ultimately, because you're really not going to be kind of simulating the same space-time. Now, what we can do is say that, okay, we don't want this secular dephasing to happen. And if you're familiar with like extreme mass ratio and spiral literature, this is exactly the same thing that happens. This is why people need like first order cell force, second order cell force corrections. The thing that is unique to extreme mass ratio and spirals is that you know your background solution, right? You analytically know like what a geodesic looks like on a curved black hole. So this is analytically tractable. But in our case, in order to avoid the secular dephasing, and specifically because we are interested in the merger phase, you know, that's really the gift that numerical relativity gives us, right? We can treat the n spiral and the ring down analytically. What we do is we ramp on the beyond GR scalar field close to the merger phase. So we have kind of our GR evolution. Can you guys still hear me? My headphone just kind of popped out.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So we have our GR evolution, and then we turn on the scalar field using some continuous ramping function. We turn on the source terms to the scalar field using some continuous ramping function. And then you kind of turn on these beyond GR dynamics. Now there's this question that Will asked of when is it appropriate to turn on these dynamics? Because if you don't turn them on, if you turn them on too soon, you know, you might run into this secular dephasing. And so we've kind of set tolerances here. One is that this is a quadratic dephasing, similar to kind of how it is in Emery's. And so what we basically do is one way that this dephasing manifests is through the peak amplitude of, you know, the gravitational radiation. If you start with different, in spiral starting times, like wildly different ones, you know, you're going to end up with your secular effects manifesting as some amplitude change in the gravitational radiation. Oh, excuse me, in the beyond GR correction to the gravitational radiation. Yes.
Yeah, so you said quadratic. So it's quadratic in the coupling. That's what you mean? Or?
Oh, sorry. No. This is all for one value of the coupling, right? This is all for just the GR beyond GR modification. So I haven't introduced any coupling yet. What I mean here is that just this dephasing takes a quadratic form. Like if you, it's, I think it's the same thing for Emery's, right? If you,
So this is just experimental. So that's what you see.
But
in the R1, you can say, well, what's the impact of this back reaction on itself? Here's the difference, what the impact of these other terms. Okay, but it's interesting this quadrat.
Yeah, that's right. And so what we really want is we want to pick an inspiral length. We want to pick a time at which we turn on these beyond GR sources, such that, this effect is basically mitigated. And we find that, for example, for DCS, around 200 m before merger is an appropriate time to turn this on. Now that gives you about 5 orbits, which is okay for GW150914, because that's the number of orbits that were detected. And when I talk about like gravitational wave data analysis pipelines, which I'm going to talk about in a second here, you know, we're mindful of that. We pick a starting frequency for this analysis such that we're really kind of, you know, five orbits before the merger phase. And we're not like trying to fit an inspiral in a place where, you know, we don't have a beyond GR modification. So yes.
On that number is for non-spinning black holes, or is it for, you're also exploring, because let me just tell you what I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. So with maybe it's there, maybe it's not. If I imagine now I have a spinning black hole, where there's a non-trivial coupling with both the correction and the scatter field. Okay, so we know super radian plays out. So maybe there is a way to extract energy and put it out from the spin onto kind of a cloud of this field. And then that we're not accounting for. And then, well, the dynamics. So I don't know if this process can play out, but do we know that it cannot?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in this case, you know, it's a similar thing, right? Where you have a GR background specifically for this GW150914 simulation, we have a spin of, I think, 0.33 and negative 0.44, which given the mass ratio that we've used gives you a chi effective of 0, which is consistent with GW150914. Now, it's true that we don't back react onto each, you know, individual black hole either. Since you have, for example, the leading order correction to the space-time metric, what you can do is you can say, you know, my whole metric is this GR metric plus these corrections. And then you can do your kind of standard procedures of looking for, you know, quantities such as like apparent horizons and stuff like that. And indeed, I have a paper where I look at, you know, using this same exact scheme for isolated black holes with various spins, where I look at modifications to the black hole shadow, which are observable, well, ideally observable with the Event Horizon Telescope. And so indeed, you do get your individual black holes modified. But because we're treating it order by order for the black holes, you know, we have these leading order modifications. And so that, yeah, that's kind of one thing to keep in mind.
Right. But the concern is if one is going to say, oh, however number of hundreds of M before, it might be fine. The worry I have is that, okay, so works in supervision, pretty good things that Will and collaborators have done. Okay, it takes a long time for this energy to be exchanged and put in the environment. But yeah, these objects have been orbiting for a very, very long time. So how do I know that, yeah, a few hundred M is enough when I may be leaving to the side an effect that can transfer 10% of the mass or angular momentum, and it could be order one now after it accumulated for a very long time?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So ideally in the future, we would include corrections to the N spiral, whether through stitching to, post-Einsteinian corrections to the N spiral, which is something that I'm working on with some people from MIT, or through Leo Stein's kind of, he had a paper on the archive recently, kind of dynamical renormalization group approach, where you have a solution for each point in like binary black hole parameter space, and you can phase match at each point, and you know, you take some trajectory through this parameter space. That's still kind of in very early development. But indeed, people are thinking about how to, you know, treat the N spiral in these cases, given that NR really only can give us the, as it currently stands, for the order reduction scheme, can really only give us the merger. Yeah, so there is, you know, there is effort there, I'd say.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so, you know, another way we can think about, we can check that, you know, this is an appropriate N spiral length is, you know, when we do numerical relativity simulations, we, you know, do kind of convergence analysis, right? We run our simulations at multiple resolutions. We compare, you know, low, high, medium resolutions. And so here, what we just checked is that the difference between the gravitational waveform, you know, starting from, let's say, 200 M versus whatever this point is, like 225 or something, that it's smaller than our level of numerical error. So in other words, this is not systematically affecting us any more than we are systematically affected by numerical error. Now, okay, so we have these waveforms. Let's, you know, think about what kind of physics we can do with them. And the first kind of question that we must ask ourselves before we go off and do like 1,000 projects with these and gravitational wave detections is this question of degeneracy. So let me say that, you know, gravitational wave data lives in this like many dimensional space where you can think about, you know, each dimension as like a continuous like frequency value, a continuous like amplitude value at some frequency, for example. So, you know, let's say you sample at 2048 hertz or something, you know, then you have whatever Nyquist factor, blah, 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 but you have order like 1,000 data kind of dimensions in this data space. Now, there is a subspace of GR solutions. So there's within the space of all possible different waveforms and some things that don't even look like waveforms that you can have, you know, GR occupies some subspace. You know, if I draw some squiggle, you know, there's this question of does it correspond to a binary black hole waveform from GR with some masses and some spins? And in some cases it will, in some cases it won't. Now, the question is, You know, when, let's say I start at some point in this, you know, on this GR hyperspace, subspace, with, that has corresponds to some binary black hole parameters, right? Some mass ratio and some spins. As I change these parameters, I move along in this space, right? I change the spin on one black hole or something, I move to a different point in the space. Now, there's also a normal to this plane as I've drawn it here. And ideally, if we had a solution, if we had some gravitational waveform that was not found in GR, as we ramp on a beyond GR modification, so let's say beyond GR waveforms were not in DCS and in Einstein Delton Gauss Bonnet gravity were not degenerate with GR, in this case, I would have a direction that is be traveling in a direct in a direction that has a piece that is orthogonal to this plane. So this is just this kind of basic question of degeneracy versus non-degeneracy. If everything is totally hopeless, then any sort of beyond GR modification, whether DCS or EDGB, is just going to move me along in this space. And I'm going to end up somewhere where my beyond GR waveform has a GR waveform with different parameters that matches it perfectly. Of course, gravitational wave detectors also have noise. So this whole thing is kind of fuzzier in the sense that you're now not just thinking about the space of GR waveforms, you're also thinking about the space of GR waveforms plus noise. And so what we've kind of done is this is work with people at Flatiron. And so Will Farr, Katerina Shatsianu, and Max Isi, where we've taken these beyond GR waveforms and we've injected them into LIGO-Virgo search pipelines. So here, for example, for various values of the DCS coupling parameter, so here is zero. This is corresponding to general relativity. Here is just using a waveform model that's going to be used for gravitational wave data analysis. So for people who are familiar, this is the kind of latest surrogate model that we have. It's sitting right on top of the GR waveform that basically just tells us, to the point where you can't even see it, that basically just tells us that our numerical GR, numerical relativity simulation is of good quality. And then, you know, as I turn on values of L that are, you know, non-zero, then I see these modifications. Now, this is all done at the same signal to noise ratio. So you can see that, yes, you know, this thing has higher amplitude here, this, you know, this L equals 37 kilometers blue curve, but it has lower kind of amplitude here. And so I've changed the amplitude of these waveforms just by virtue of changing the distance to them when I, you know, inject them at some astrophysical distance in order to have the same signal to noise ratio for all of them. And so one kind of search that we've done is using model independent searches. So for people who are in LIGO-Virgo, you may be familiar with BayesWave, where basically what you do is you have some, you know, data from your gravitational wave detector, and you fit it with a series of wavelets. And this is often used in practice, and you assume that the signal came from some point, one point in the sky, you know, traveled to both detectors at the speed of light. But beyond that, you're not making any sort of assumptions. And so, you know, people in LIGO use this pipeline to sort of differentiate between signal and noise, right? Because for signal, you want consistency between your two LIGO detectors or Virgo if you include it as well. But with noise, for example, that's just going to be in one detector. It's not going to be consistent with, you know, something from some point in the sky. It's not going to travel at the speed of light or anything. And so this is often used for LIGO glitch versus like signal analysis. And so there's this question of if we use this model independent search pipeline, can we still recover these beyond GR waveforms? So if I take my injections that I had in this previous plot, four different values of L. So here's L equals zero, which is GR. And here I'm like progressively going larger and larger in L. Can we accurately reconstruct the beyond GR waveforms using this pipeline? And the answer is yes, we can. We can reconstruct them as well as we can reconstruct GR waveforms. Here is for two different signal to noise ratios. So on top is signal to noise ratio 25, which is kind of a characteristic signal to noise ratio of, you know, a little less than GW15 and 914. And here is signal to noise ratio 75, which is kind of pertaining to a next generation, right, of detections. And so you can see that.
Sorry if I interrupt. Yeah. There's a question by Suvadip if you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yes.
Hi, Masha. Nice talk. I mean, I have a question regarding what Luis was asking before. So when you, if you go to a previous slide and you compare with observation, so, I mean, how the you include the propagation effect? Because I assume there'll be a degeneracy along the line of waveform of the source and the propagation. So when you are talking about the signal imprinted at the merger and at the inspiral phase, how much the change is for a given theory going to happen from propagation, that also needs to be included, right?
Yeah, so ideally you would have a full pipeline that allows for modifications to source frame dynamics, as well as you know, modifications to propagation. And LIGO presently does, and not to put the blame on them, but you know, they presently don't even do this kind of full search, right? Where you include both, let's say, parameterized post-Einsteinian effects and propagation effects. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really interesting point to, you know, in the future kind of couple everything together. Now, there's this question of, you know, in Trin-Simons gravity, for example, in order to deal with these propagation effects, you have to pick some global scalar field profile and, you know, assume that you're not moving through other high curvature regions of space-time where you have, you know, an additional scalar field as this thing is propagating. So yes, you do have to pick, you know, some global scalar field profile, and this changes your detected inclination angle in the case of LIGO. Yeah, so that's something to definitely include. This is also something that you can test in a model independent way just by looking at the distribution of inclination angles that you see in LIGO. And I have a paper from earlier in this year on doing that with LIGO data. But absolutely, I think a thing that we must include in tests of general relativity in the future is including both source frame and propagation effects together, because, you know, you could get degeneracies.
That's right.
There as well. Yeah.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the answer to all of these questions is there's a lot of work to be done still. So, you know, this isn't like the final word on anything. So indeed, we can recover these beyond GR waveforms with this model independent search just as well as we can recover GR waveforms. And you can kind of look at it here. So, for example, as I increase the signal to noise ratio, this is the difference between, oh, I should have said, this dashed black line is my injected waveform, and then the colored curves are the recovered waveforms with, you know, some, you know, 95th percentile confidence business. So in the bottom panels, they're basically lying on top of each other. In the top panels, you have some spread around your injected waveform. Yeah, so, you know, you can do things like quantify the mismatch between your recovered waveform and your injected waveform as a function of signal to noise ratio. You see that for all values of L, you get this, you know, characteristic root, 1 over root SNR squared kind of curve, where in all cases, basically what this tells you, if you're kind of familiar with phase wave stuff, is that you are, you know, as you increase signal to noise ratio, you are able to more and more faithfully recover your injected waveform, no matter the value of L. Now, there's this question that really kind of probes this degeneracy question that I asked earlier about what happens if we assume general relativity. Let's say we have a beyond GR waveform and we run it through a LIGO Virgo parameter estimation pipeline that assumes general relativity. What it's going to do for us is it's going to try to match our injected waveform to like a million or 10 million GR waveforms and see if we can get a good enough match between a beyond GR waveform and some GR waveform with some, you know, values of the parameters. And you know, this is all done using codes like LAL inference or Bilby, using things like Markov chain Monte Carlo and nested sampling techniques. And so this is all kind of in the realm of Bayesian inference. And so indeed, what we've done is we've taken our, you know, injected beyond GR waveforms and run them through these LIGO-Virgo parameter estimation pipelines that use just waveforms from general relativity against the data. And just to double check, we use the, just on a technical note, we use the surrogate model from that is trained on numerical relativity simulations. So if you are deep in the gravitational waves community, we use a gravitational wave template model that is consistent with numerical relativity to recover this numerical relativity simulation. You know, we're not using effective one body, we're not using, this is a corner plot where I have injected data for different values of L with an SNR of 75. And then I have, you know, I have some, you know, known GR parameters. So here, you know, the blue is general relativity. And then the black kind of lines here are the injected values for the parameters. And so basically what happened for the GR case. So basically what happens here is just focusing on the blue, which is GR, we have a mass ratio, a chirp mass, two spin magnitudes that we are going to recover, and then a right ascension and a declination. We also have other things like, you know, trigger time, phase, distance to the source and stuff. Those are all recovered well, but the quantities of interest that I'm showing this plot are the ones that I just listed. So what happens in this case is as I increase the value of L, in some cases, I move away from the, you know, beyond GR solution. So, excuse me, from the GR values. So for example, for the spins, you know, the GR value of the spin is recovered quite well. It's, you know, says, you know, it's 0.33 in this case. But then as I introduce these beyond GR corrections, this pipeline says, let me really try to match these. And it tries to find the waveforms which best match these beyond GR waveforms. And in this case, it, you know, tends to push it to higher spins. And then here on the right is the same deal, but it's with just SNR 125. So these are ladder injections and you expect these kind of contours to be tighter in this space, but you still see things like a vast modification in spin. And we're going to look at recovered waveforms in a second to kind of see how these things match up. So
question by Reed, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, Maria, if this is about to come, I can wait. But my understanding is that the deviations are causing the inspiral to be faster, right? Because you have another energy source that's you're losing energy through the scalar field, basically. But it seems like the biases that you're seeing would increase the length of the waveform. Because if you have large aligned spins, then it's, you know, that would stretch out the waveform.
And like anti-aligned, but or like one up, one down. But I think that the greatest modification is coming from the modification that you get to the kind of profile, the amplitude profile of the waveform, which I'll show. And I think that if, and so this is something, this is all work in progress. So we're all like currently, you know, kind of testing this. But I think if we were to do tons of inspiral cycles, you know, then kind of phase corrections would win out. And you would, for example, do things like, you know, push towards mass ratio equal one, for example, in an effort to reflect the fact that, you know, you're supposed to be, that you're losing energy to the scalar field. But in this case, which I think I'll show in two slides, really the higher spin case kind of best matches the amplitude profile. And one thing that I should also mention is that we're not allowing for any change in spin tilts when we do this search. We're just saying we have one spin like this, one spin like this, as we had when we injected. And this is because since we're doing a chi effective equals zero injection, it's very hard to appropriately nail down the spin tilts. And we have, there's a whole like kind of computation that Will and I have done around this, but it's basically led us to say that, you know, for this chi effective equals zero, like precisely at zero, not small, but like precisely at zero injection, you kind of get this breakdown in the kind of spin tilt search. And so we've just pushed for you know, known values of the spin tilt as we have, but indeed you would want to do ideally a full search with precession and stuff like
Masha,
that.
Masha, on that, I got confused. You have these fields, the kind of the perturbed fields, the first order fields are kind of responding, and then that's what gives you the waveforms. But the black holes are not going any faster. They are not merging any faster because you're not back reacting, right?
Yes. So the modifications that you get are really, so you get some phase modifications because, you know, if you add to the, because the leading order correction has, so mainly you get amplitude modifications, and you get, as we showed in a 2019 or 2018 paper, the, for example, for the, ring down, let's say, you can write down, and I know we're talking about the unspiral, but for the ring down, for example, if you take like, you know, some quasi-normal mode and you perturb this quasi-normal mode, so you say that, you know, my beyond GR solution is, you know, my leading order beyond GR solution is a leading order quasi-normal mode correction. In that case, if you take a quasi-normal mode and you correct it to leading order, you know, you're going to get a piece that's just an amplitude correction. You're not going to get, you know, you differentiate like sine phi t, you know, you're not going to get any sort of different phase there. You're going to get an amplitude correction. And so here, I think, you know, we are just seeing the sensitivity to the amplitude correction. You know, we've tried to get rid of systematic effects in terms of secular breakdown.
Right, I think the interpretation that I would give it is like the efficiency of conversion of energy budget that you have, given some motion of your sources to gravitational waves, is slightly different, but the engine is working in exactly the same way for your particular setup where you use the background solution and then you perturb on top of it. Do you agree with that?
I have to think about that. I apologize, okay. But yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. So looking at, let's say but before I show the reconstructed waveforms, one thing that I do want to point out is the fact that the recovery contours are smaller, let's say, for larger values of L. So you can see, for example, you know, recall that these are all injected at the same signal to noise ratio in one of these plots. And in this case, you know, for the GR values, you see there's quite a bit of spread in, let's say, this spin mass ratio contour plot. But you can see that these beyond GR ones are quite tight. And basically, you can kind of explain this using the following logic. So just focusing on this left plot, in general relativity, so recall this kind of high dimensional like data space that we were talking about before. In general relativity, let's say we just take two dimensions of this. So we have, you know, the amplitude at some frequency and then amplitude of another frequency, for example. You know, we have the plane of possible GR solutions here that, you know, give you waveforms that are consistent with general relativity. And you say that, okay, I have a waveform, which is my true injected waveform. It's right here on this plane. Then when you think about data, like actual gravitational wave detector data, you add some noise to this value, and then you get out, you know, your data. So since you're working backwards, since you're dealing with data, and then you're asking about possible GR solutions that could have led to this signal that you're seeing right here, you basically say, well, I have a sphere here in this space of, this is the amount of noise that I expect to kind of have. So you have this kind of fuzzy noise cloud, let's say, and really what you're interested in is the intersection of this, you know, fuzzy cloud with your GR plane. So basically this says that each of these solutions here is consistent with, you know, my data being some GR signal plus noise. So that's kind of the picture here. And then in the beyond GR case, your true waveform, so the injected waveform that you have, if it is non-degenerate with general relativity, you don't expect it to live on this plane. So it's expected to live somewhere else. If you then add noise to it, in some direction, and you say, okay, now I have this data point that I've detected. If again, you draw this kind of fuzzy noise contour around it, and you ask about the intersection of that fuzzy noise contour with this GR plane, right? Remember that we're testing the data against known GR solutions. Then we end up with a much tighter contour. In this case, for the same, let's say, amount of noise. And so that is kind of the reason why you see tighter contours in the case where you have, the beyond GR waveform instead of the GR waveform. Now, looking at reconstructions, so this is me taking the maximum likelihood waveform and just comparing it to the injected waveform. And so in this case, this is for the GR case. So you can see that it reconstructs quite well. The injected waveform is in the dashed line, and then the reconstructed is a curve. Now, this is just one point in, you know, this kind of cloud or this posterior truly distribution that is consistent with the injected data. But, you know, for illustrative purposes, you know, you can see that you can recover the signal with, you know, at least some, you know, waveforms. And then as you turn on beyond GR effects, so here's, you know, 25 kilometers, and then you kind of increase it, you see that the waveform that the data analysis pipeline thinks is, you know, of the highest likelihood, even though, you know, you're really taking something from where it thinks it has the highest likelihood, you know, you still, oops, excuse me, I went the wrong way. You still don't get something that is consistent with the injected waveform. So for example, in this kind of extreme case, you have this injected waveform that has this like amplitude modification here, the kind of profile of this thing kind of going up is different from anything that the GR pipeline tries to match against it. And we can kind of look at this through the lens.
I realized you would have had his hands up for quite a while.
Sorry. Yes.
Alan, sorry, thanks for observing. Yeah. So I have a question regarding, you know, like two slides back when you are showing the, So how much it depends on the fiducial value of spin you choose. So the predicted deviation from GR will depend on the fiducial value of spin of the black holes?
Yes. So in dynamical Trans-Siemens gravity, for example, the larger the spin you have for the same value of the, the larger the spin value you have, the larger your deviation. So in the order reduction scheme, for example, the larger the spin you have, the larger this correction to the metric. And recall that Schwarzschild is a solution of dynamical Trans-Siemens gravity. So really it's when you ramp on spin that you get modifications. And I've also shown this for the black hole shadow. I've also shown this for quasi-normal modes in this theory. Here we've done this for one injection. And the reason we've kind of done this for one injection is because it's worth kind of considering the question of if I have a typical astrophysical system like that of GW150914, and it turns out that this thing is like fully degenerate with general relativity to the point where, you know, I can't possibly pick up on this thing with search pipelines, because remember the model independent search pipeline can pick this thing out of the data, but then the GR search pipeline can't match it. And so that tells you something about there being a piece there, a piece of signal there that GR can't account for. Now, if it turns out that GR and beyond GR are fully degenerate, or at least degenerate for this astrophysical case, you know, then the situation is kind of hopeless, because you can't, you know, you're not going to be able to detect beyond GR modifications at all. You're just going to run into some incorrect, you know, solution that doesn't match the source parameters. But, you know, if you want to do a full study where you do like 1,000 different injections with different parameters and you look for degeneracies, then you kind of have to justify doing 1,000 numerical relativity simulations, which we are capable of doing. You know, we released a catalog in 2019 of just GR numerical relativity simulations of something like 2,000 simulations that we collected over the years. But nevertheless, it is an expensive endeavor that would require like 10^8 CPU hours. So we were thinking, do this degeneracy study, the smaller study first, potentially use it to motivate, you know, doing these things. Because when I've studied black hole shadows and quasi-normal modes, these things are non-degenerate with general relativity, which is good. But now there's this question of, okay, if I have a, you know, the full merger waveform, what yeah. happens? And that's kind of the motivation for this study.
Good. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Question.
Yes.
Yeah. Regarding the spin.
Sorry.
You have to, you said you don't have exact analytic solutions of the field equations. Aren't you restricted to slowly rotating black holes? Because you have to obtain a spin by approximate methods.
Yeah, so there are a couple of ways you can do this. So one thing, so here I've kind of naively said, you know, I expect the modification to be small. I expect the black, okay. Let me backtrack. In numerical relativity, if you have a space-time and you want to, you know, compute the black hole spin, you do something like you look for an approximate killing vector in the space-time, for example, and that allows you to quantify the spin. There are many different ways, in the same way that, you know, in if you take a mathematical relativity approach, there are many different ways to quantify mass. There are also different ways in which we can compute spin. And thankfully, they're more or less consistent with one another in practice. Now, if you wanted to do this in the order reduction scheme case, so you know, I give you any sort of binary black hole or single black hole system in numerical relativity, we know how to compute numerically the spin. Now, if I did a beyond GR case, I would have to do, using the order reduction scheme, I'd have to kind of do the same thing where I would, you know, write down this equation that I would solve for an approximate killing vector, but then you'd kind of have to perturb it in order to deal with the fact that you're working in this perturbative series. But then you would, but then you would, what would you do? But then, and then you would compute basically like what the change to the spin is. Now, in this case, it doesn't really matter whether or not I've changed significantly changed the spins of the black holes, because you can see that, you know, no matter what the spin of the black holes of this injected waveform are, you know, you can't recover it. You do have a scenario where you can't use, you know, GR to recover this beyond GR waveform. And then if you wanted to be really precise, you know, I could go back to the simulation and, you know, compute the black hole spin for you on this, you know, full space time. Yeah.
I do have another comment. A 100 years ago, Arthur Eddington showed the quadratic contributions to GR for the solar system are tiny. It's published in his book, The Mathematical Theory of Relativity. Also for scalar tensor gravity, the scalar contributions are tiny, for example, in Brown-Sticky theory. So you expect that as the black holes in spiraling, the corrections would increase as the black holes merge. And for some distance out, the corrections are tiny. In fact, isn't that what you see?
Well, you would still get, you know, you'd still get corrections to the metric around each black hole, right? And so when you write down, you know, an in-spiral and you have a modified action. So when you do PM theory calculations, even though at like lowest order, you know, it's a while before you add tidal forces, it's a while before you really treat these things as extended bodies. But even for the, you know, even if you were to consider the point source case, because in the full theory you have a different action, you know, I assume that the standard way of doing PN calculations would be modified. And indeed, people like my colleague Leo Stein and Kent Yagi and Nico Yunes have done, you know, PN calculations in these theories. So, you know, you do get modifications even when these things are in spiraling.
Yeah, by the way, Stephen Hawking proved that in the scalar tensor theories, for example, Brown-Sticky, that the black holes for the spherical symmetric case ratio and for the axial symmetric case identical to GR.
That's right. So there's this question about what theories are interesting to test. And for example, scalar tensor theories are interesting to test in the context of systems with matter, like neutron stars and supernovae, because there you do get modified dynamics. But then in the case of black holes, the systems basically are equivalent between GR and like Brown-Stickians or something. And so in those cases, to really test those theories, you need a system of matter, or you need a system with a very contrived gravitational like potential field. So people have also thought about this, but indeed to place constraints on these theories, it's best to have systems with matter.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so going back to these, now there's this question about, okay, we have these injected waveforms, how well can we, you know, recover this business? And in this case, this is just the injected waveforms for various values of L. And then this is the reconstructed waveforms. And so in this case, the colors are the same. They correspond to the same value of L. But here I've denoted the values of spin that the pipeline thinks best fit this data. And so you can kind of see that it likes higher spin values because they allow for this kind of higher amplitude right here. And again, I should mention that this whole business is with a frequency cutoff of 25 hertz. So really you're kind of more sensitive to these later times. And I should mention that this system has 68 solar masses. So you don't have like 100 cycles of inspiral within the LIGO bucket. In fact, you only have like a few. And so, you know, this is kind of what the pipeline, I would say, is telling us. And moreover, if we ramp on the value of L, you know, we see that no matter the SNR that we inject at, we do see that, you know, there is a difference between the GR waveform and the injected waveform. So there are arguments to be made about, you know, why this physics is, like, why we're pushing towards, the pipeline is pushing towards higher spin. You know, what the effect of the fact that we're doing the order reduction scheme has to do with this. But the present beyond GR waveforms that we have can't be recovered faithfully with these LIGO pipelines. And before I kind of close out here, just jumping back to our kind of first papers and thinking about astrophysical constraints. So this whole business is work in progress. But, you know, thinking back to papers that we've already published, you can project bounds for GW5914-like systems through our first simulations for the system where we were just doing scalar field. We sort of said that we would, again, expect constraints at the order of the black hole horizon scale, the order of like 10 kilometers. This is just some tolerance on the phase. This is much stronger than solar system constraints, which are currently around 10 to the 8 kilometers. So we're doing a factor of 10 to the 7 better with binary black hole systems than we are with solar system tests. This is for dynamical Chern-Simons gravity. For Einstein Dilaton-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, just very loosely computing mismatches. So before we even did any sort of injection pipeline stuff, just computing mismatches between the GR waveform and the beyond GR waveform for various value of L, also, you know, marginalizing over time and phase. You know, you can see that if I ask for a percentage mismatch of 1%, or, you know, a percentage mismatch of 4%, which is kind of what was seen in the first LIGO testing GR paper, I would expect a value of this EDGB coupling parameter for Einstein-Dilaton-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, again, to be of order 10 kilometers. But as I mentioned before, Einstein-Dilaton-Gauss-Bonnet gravity has much lower order post-Newtonian corrections. And so you can actually constrain it already with things like X-ray binaries. And so this theory has already been constrained to around, you know, 10 kilometers for the length scale. So, you know, binary black hole mergers really serve us much better in DCS than they do in testing EDGB. And then just a quick note about the coming decades of beyond GR gravitational wave astronomy. So ideally, as I mentioned, you know, we would have many beyond GR simulations. We'd have enough that we have, you know, a sizable catalog, and then we could build a surrogate model that could interpolate between these waveforms so that for any value of BBH parameter space, you know, we could give you a simulation, recalling again that these length scales scale out. So really, you know, we get a GR simulation, which is useful, but then, you know, you also get these beyond GR pieces. And then I just wanted to mention that there are exciting coming decades of gravitational wave astronomy. In particular, you know, interesting are our advanced LIGO upgrades, and then Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer kind of hanging out here, because these do probe the higher curvature regime. LISA is also, you know, very exciting as well. But, you know, for tight constraints, you want lower mass binaries. And just to summarize, we said GR must break down at some scale. You know, binary black hole mergers probe the nonlinear dynamical strong field regime of gravity. They're perhaps our best laboratory for seeing any sort of beyond GR effects. The fact that we need model-dependent tests of general relativity, which is where numerical relativity beyond general relativity comes in, because we need predictions for these things. I talked about, okay, we have these first waveforms. And then I talked about, oh, I forgot to put it here. We talked about like some data analysis stuff. And then I talked about kind of the coming decades. And thank you so much to all of my collaborators on this effort. And now I'm happy to take any additional questions. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Masha, for this wonderful talk in two parts. We had lots of discussion already along the way, but I see there's more questions. So I think Juan was first.
Hi, Masha. Thanks for the very nice talk. Yeah, so if we go back to the constraints on EDGB and Chen Simon that you got right here. So if you just use the inspire waveform to constrain these parameters, like, is it better or worse than this constraint?
Oh, that's a good question. So for this simulation that we did, and this is from the 2017 paper that we have, and for this simulation that we did, we simulated about 5 cycles as well. This is just for the scalar field. So we just did the leading order DCS scalar field. And we did, so we just did the leading order DCS scalar field, and we just made estimates based on the energy in the scalar field. Now, if you were to do things, I forget, yes. So Miko Yunes, Kent Yagi, Leo Stein, and Tanaka, I think, have a paper from 2013 where they calculate the PN's kind of series for the leading order scalar field. And I think that they estimated that you should, similarly with an SNR of 25, you should be able to do also a constraint of order 10. If I'm remembering correctly, I think that's what they said in that paper. If you want more details, the 2017 paper has a whole like comparison table of bounds, as does the EDGB GW5914 paper. I apologize that I didn't include those here. But yeah, I think that those are the bounds that they had in that 2013 paper.
Okay, so you're saying it could be comparable. Yeah, I guess I'm just curious, let's say if we want to use the merger part to constrain the parameter, or we decide to use the inspire part to constrain the parameter, which one might be better?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's also dependent on what system they picked for their paper. So yeah, that's a good comparison to kind of revisit. And it's also very important for Lisa and DeSaigo, which I showed here, because there, you know, these allow you to do many, many, many cycles for stellar mass binary black holes for, you know, 5 years or something before they merge in LIGO. So yeah, that would be a good study to do. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Can I ask a related question to the one Juan just asked? So in EDGB, there's a minimum mass for the black hole that you can have, right? For a given coupling parameter. So how does the bounds that you were showing us compare to the bound that you get just if you say, okay, I take the smallest mass black hole in my binary and say that the coupling has to be not big enough so you couldn't have that black hole?
Yes. So that thing, I think, gives you around 2 or 3 solar masses. Excuse me, 2 or 3 kilometers. So I'm looking at my paper right now. I apologize. Okay, here we go. Yes, so that analysis was done. Okay, so there are a couple of different analyses. Yes, there's this maximum, there's this condition that you mentioned that I think puts you around, like order 1 kilometer. There's this constraint from Helvi Witek et al. For a 15, 12, 26 type system, which had lower masses than GW5914. It had masses, I think, of 8 and 12. And so in that case, they placed a constraint of, you know, saying that if this thing is consistent with GR, you could constrain it up to 2.7 kilometers. compact star stability, there we go, can give you 5.4 kilometers. So this is the paper. This is the paper from Pani, Berti, Cardoso, and Reed. And then LIGO SNR 30 detections from this Leo Stein and Kent Yagi paper quotes order 1 to 10 kilometers for EDGB. So the numbers that I quoted to you, Juan, were for DCS. For PPE analysis for GW50914 by Takura, Yagi, and Carson, this was quoted at 50 kilometers. So that kind of tells you something about this, you know, the extent to which you know, PPE analysis was able to constrain it. As I mentioned, X-ray binary orbital decay does 10 kilometers, and then Cassini-Shapiro time delay does about 10 to the 7 kilometers for Einstein dilaton Gauss-Bonnet.
Sorry, just a quick note to Will. John Wei recently did this parameter estimation using these two new events, black hole neutron star events from LIGO. I think the constraints on this EDGB parameter is updated to be less than, I think it's less than 1 kilometer, yeah, because black hole mass is small for these two systems.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Ramiro has a question.
I think Luis had a question before me. I think he raised his hand before, but if
So going back to the order reduction procedure you use, that's at least where I see it seems to be like people use it in an iterative fashion, where after you got your corrective solution to say order L to the fourth, in principle you could use that to create your sources to like a higher order. So I was wondering if by doing that, just as an experiment or just to see what happens, if that could help you with the secular effect part. I don't know. I was just wondering if like just doing the iterations once more would help you, you know, minimize the secular effect.
So you would still have issues with the rate of and spiral of the black holes, because you wouldn't have any back reactions. So you wouldn't kind of get rid of the root cause. Ideally, when people, yeah, so I'm not sure that would help. I think instead doing this type of stitching or doing Leo's kind of renormalization group approach would be more powerful. But you know, I think I'm sure there are more interesting dynamics at higher orders as well as people have also thought about cubic theories of gravity. But I'm not terribly familiar with those. I've just read a few papers. Yeah.
Okay. So just as a clarification, because I don't know if every time you've been saying this, I have not been understanding when you're saying there's no back reaction. So I understand first you make your GR simulation. Then with this, you obtain your sources, you plug it back into Einstein's equations or the modified Einstein's equations, and then you evolve this, where this metric is now going to feel the modifications from these source terms. So my question is, in this latest simulation, do your black holes merge faster or they don't?
They don't.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So that's a bigger problem than I thought. Okay.
It's a bigger problem, but we try to mitigate it again by focusing on the in spiral through kind of this business. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other final questions or comments?
Yeah, I have one.
Mm-hmm.
May I?
Please.
So Masha, as you said, so I mean, I like this wavelets approach because it's trying to be agnostic, but wink, wink, it's not that agnostic, right? So the shape is chosen so as to kind of, it's motivated in part by what you think a merger will look like. So if I wink, wink one more time, can you have you guys kind of tried to use a little bit of the information of what your waveforms are kind of telling you to kind of inform a little bit more the wavelets to try and see if you can lower somewhat the SNR required to start telling things apart? I mean, short of using a template, but just going one step further.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So indeed, there are different classes of wavelets that people use for this, what's known as the Bayes wave analysis. So there are like wavelets that are more appropriate for modeling glitches. And then there are, you know, this whole thing just looks like a wavelet, right? And then, you know, there are, you know, I think, you know, penalties on how many wavelets you use. We allow up to 40 wavelets, and fewer, far fewer are used. I think like maybe 8 end up being used. So that's an interesting question. I think it also will allow you to probe kind of, you know, systematic effects of using one wavelet family over the other. I don't know if that study's just been done in general using Bayes wave, the benefits of one family of wavelets over the other. You know, you just have some requirements that they form, like some like basis requirements, I guess. But yeah, that's a good question. And we currently haven't done anything like this. Yeah.
Thank you.